very much for the invitation to come here and talk about some of the work we do or the region of the brain that I work on. And also, I love to be in this building. This building is my favourite building in Oxford. I love it. The Cathedral to Science. And I've organised a few events to take place in this building. I just love it. Actually, the other thing is I should tell you that at one time I used to help the beekeeper who looked after the bees up on the turret there, which is still there now. I still keep bees, but I don't help them. So I'm a scientist who works on the brain, and I'm working on a part of the brain called the basal ganglia. And the basal ganglia are regions of the brain involved in a lot of diseases. And the principal disease is Parkinson's disease. But also that area is involved in lots of other things like Huntington's disease. It's involved in addiction, probably some of these disorders like obsessive compulsive disorders and that sort of thing. But the thing we do mostly is to try and understand what's happening and what goes wrong in Parkinson's disease. So we work on normal animals, and this is what we work on. These little creatures here, anybody can have a look at these. This is a mouse and a rat. These are fixed brains. And these are we use as a model of the human brain. And it's quite reasonable to do that because the area of the brain is an ancient area of the brain in evolutionary terms. And anything we find in rats and mice is eventually discovered in monkeys and humans. So it's a good model. And anybody can have a look at these. They're not in anything toxic. They'll be cleaned and they're just buffered if anybody can have a look. So what I'm going to do is talk about four things. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the history of Parkinson's disease, because of course it's not a modern disease. It's a modern disease and we know more about it because we're all living older and the strongest risk factor is age. Then I'll talk about something sort of how the brain works, how I see how the brain works. And then we'll talk about what goes wrong in Parkinson's disease. And then in the last part we'll talk about how we treat Parkinson's disease now. And what are the prospects for the future to treat Parkinson's disease? So, historically, you know, throughout history, there are writings about what we now know of Parkinson's disease. So Galen, when I was working on platelets and inflammation, I used to quote him as well at the beginning of my talks, because he described rheumatoid arthritis. So he described Parkinson's disease and people with Parkinson's disease. He studied motor disorders a lot, and he wrote something, apparently, on tremor, palpitations, convulsions. And then this is a description of somebody with Parkinson's disease. He lies rigid in bed, as if he were made of wood. Tremor, constipation, and psychiatric symptoms are other symptoms that he described all this time ago. And then even some of the great scientists of the Middle Ages described Parkinson's disease. So Leonardo da Vinci described it also. The movements of paralytics, somebody with Parkinson's disease who can't move, whose head and members move without control of the soul. This is the tremor that Parkinson's people have. And I'll show you all this in a moment. And then our very own, this is a long quote coming now, it's our very own Thomas Willis, who was here in Oxford, probably one of the first neurologists and first experimental neurologists. He was the first to really describe the area of the brain that I work on. He called them the corpora striata. You can still call it the corpus striatum. He actually got about how it works a little bit wrong, because he was talking about images, spirits and images going through the brain. But what he did describe was that in those who suffer or have died from paralysis, that's probably Parkinson's disease, and I've often observed that these corpora are affected. So he identified that the region of the brain, the basal ganglia, actually are affected in those people who are dying with Parkinson's disease. And then along came James Parkinson in 1817. This is a facsimile of his. I've got a note in here from a student who gave it to me. Here's a going away present. And he wrote this essay on the shaking palsy. And he really described the symptoms. Anybody can take a look at this and pass it around. He really described the symptoms: involuntary tremulous motion, lessened muscle power, propensity to bend forward, and we'll see the real symptoms in a moment. Difficulty in walking, changing into a running pace. He said the senses and the intellect being uninjured, and I'll talk about that again in a moment. So he described it as paralysis agitans, And it wasn't until quite some time later that Jean-Martin Charcot in Paris, actually, who was really interested in this disease, described more of the symptoms of this disease and said, you know, paralysis agitans is probably not a good name for it. Let's call it Parkinson's disease. And the reason it's called Parkinson's disease is not because of Parkinson, it's because of this guy here, Charcot in Paris. And he introduced the first treatment. This was an alkaloid that was extracted from a datura, if that's how you pronounce it, which includes the angel trumpet. And you extract this alkaloid called hyoscine. That's very, very similar to an alkaloid called atropine, which comes from deadly nightshade. And he introduced that as a treatment for Parkinson's disease. And actually, it was still, that type of drug is still used today for some aspects of the disease, which again I'll talk about later. So this treatment actually was better than what this guy introduced. And if you read this, he suggested beaver testes prepared with vinegar and roses was helpful, not only for lethargy, but also good for tremblings and convulsions. And you could either drink the stuff or you could anoint it onto your muscles. I doubt whether it works. Okay, so what are the symptoms of Parkinson's disease? Symptoms of Parkinson's disease are... When I'm talking to lay people, I often say it's the symptoms are the doddering old man. So you have a hunched posture, a tremor, difficulty in initiating movement, rigidity, and then movement will start, and you have this very characteristic shuffling gait. And often this shuffling gait falls into a type of walking like that or running like that. So stooped posture, muscle stiffness, urgent bladder, this sometimes cramps and things, shuffling gait, tremor, hands and hands. And of course, things like swallowing and talking are also muscular activities, movement activities. So in a movement disorder, you have problems swallowing, and you often get this, you often get drooling, and you get a soft speech. And then very characteristic is this masked face, because to maintain my expressions on my face, I'm using muscles all the time. When you're not, your muscles aren't working, then you have this massive expression. And often the symptoms arise asymmetrically. So often the symptoms will arise on one side of the body first, actually very commonly. And often you can see, you know, just walking in the street, you can see somebody with Parkinson's disease because they'll be walking along, one arm swinging and the other not. And then eventually you'll see people walking on the street with neither arm swinging. And often you then look at them and you see this very blank expression. Very easy. They're all the motor symptoms of the disease, but it's not just a motor disease. So preceding the motor symptoms, we have other symptoms as well. So constipation is very common. Sleep disorders are very common. Some people say that Parkinson's people smell badly, which actually doesn't mean they smell badly, but they have olfactory problems and they can't smell. Eventually, as the disease progresses beyond the major motor symptoms, then you will begin to get cognitive impairment as well. So those are the classic symptoms of the disease. So it's the second most common neurological disorder. I hear that your last talk was about Alzheimer's disease. That's the most common neurological disorder. We're the second most common. There are young onset forms. Michael J. Fox has young onset Parkinson's disease. 1% of people over 60, unfortunately, I just last year got into that category, so I have a 1% chance of getting it. And 10% of people over 80, and it's slightly more common in us men, I'm sorry to say. And so it's a progressive disease. This disease just continually progresses. You've had Parkinson's disease probably 15 or 20 years before you see those motor symptoms. And then, mostly, it's an idiopathic disease, meaning we don't know what the cause is and why you get Parkinson's disease. We just don't know why. There are some genetic forms, but mostly we've got no idea why you get it. Probably the main problem is that you grow old. Okay, let me just show you what somebody looks like. So this is a guy. I'm not going to take the sound off for this. He's in his young onset Parkinson's. This is quite pixelated, I'm sorry, but you'll get the idea. He was young onset, this guy's 55, and so he's had it for some time. And there he has his stooped posture, arms not swinging, shuffling gait. When I give talks in schools, I get the kids to walk up and down and show me how easy it is to walk up and down and then go him to turn around. He's going to be told to turn around now. And you see this fairy. So before the treatments, his disease would just get worse and worse, and he would be trapped in his body. And his mind would be completely normal for most of the progression of the disease, and he would just be trapped in his body. And there's a little demonstration you can do. Not everybody can do it, but I'm going to use one of these healthy volunteers over here to show you how to do it. So if you come over here.
So what I'm going to do is, this is to
illustrate. You can try this at home. You can try this at home. Don't try this at home. And it's when your mind is telling your muscles to do something and it just won't do it. Okay, so I want you to lean against there.
Put your foot right against the wall. Put this foot further in, right next to it. Right, keep the shoulder and foot there.
Now lift this foot up.
This outside.
Yeah. You're telling your muscle to move. Your mind is telling your muscle, and it just won't happen. Do it again. Try that. You'll see what it feels like. Okay. Thank you. Please try that, because it gives a real feeling of, you know, how difficult it is for somebody in that situation. And as I say, before the treatments, you became completely enclosed. You eventually were sitting on a chair and not being able to move, blank face, drooling, not being able to leave. Okay, so I'm going to move away from Parkinson's for a moment and just talk about how the brain works. In a very reductionist way. So the brain, here's a little model of our brain. So this, we were just talking about it earlier, how fantastic the brain is. It's the most amazing thing, as far as we know, in the whole universe. And it's probably the pinnacle of evolution in the universe, a lesson or other civilization. So how does the brain work? Actually, school kids like this picture as well. I just got it from the internet because there's some very unbiological lines here. There's a line there and a line there. Anybody want to guess what they are?
Scissors.
Yeah, it's a saw. When the saw went into the cranium to get it out. Okay, so this is our computer. This runs us. So I'd like to use a computer analogy. If you've never seen a computer before, or you've never touched a computer before, you have no idea what it is or what it does, what would you do? You might start to tap on the keyboard and you begin to see things happening, a reaction. You see things on the screen and eventually you might work out there's some logic in this, and then you might be able to begin to work out what this thing does and get clues as to how this does it. That's not how I study the brain. That's how psychologists do it. And there's plenty of psychologists here in Oxford who do that. What we do is the little boy thing. We open it up, take it apart, and look at all the components in the computer, and look at how all the components are connected, and what these components do to each other, and how they interact. And of course, the component in our brain is the nerve cell. And we have in our brain, the current estimate is about 80 billion nerve cells. We have about 80 billion nerve cells, and we have also about 80 million glial cells, and of course we have that as well. So 80 billion, we're now getting into the astronomical figures, the type that Brian Cox talks about, and we'll go even higher in a moment. So to fit 80 billion into here, of course they have to be tiny. So this is an image of one single nerve cell. This is a nerve cell from the area of the brain that I'm interested in. It's a nerve cell from the rat brain, but if it was from a human, a monkey, a cat, or whatever, I would not be able to tell the difference. This is what it looks like in every species. This is a dreadful neuron. It's called a medium-sized density spiny neuron. I always wish that one of the great anatomists in the 19th century had worked on it and it would have a nicer name. But we're stuck with this medium-sized density spiny. Now, neurons are special cells in the body. They have three characteristics. They have this region here, which is called the cell body. This is our scale here, so this is about 10 microns across, that's 100,000th of a meter across, it's tiny.
That's where all the business that goes on in a cell goes on. That's where the nucleus is, that's where protein synthesis is, that's where turnover of proteins is, that's where all the normal business of every cell in the body goes on, in the cell body here. But then nerve cells have two other characteristics. They have these structures, which are called dendrites. These are the aerials of the cell. These are the aerials which are receiving information from other neurons. Okay?
So I now turn to my high-tech teaching aid. And we have our pipe cleaner neuron. So in blue, then, is the cell body, where all the normal business of a cell goes on. And then yellow are the dendrites. And these are the receivers receiving information from other regions of the brain. I'm just going to show you another one of these, which I really think is cool. This is one of the cells that we recorded from, actually, in a mouse brain, and then we did a digital reconstruction of it. And you can see all the cell bodies just here, and here the dendrites, and we're rotating it. This is actually now from a mouse, and the other one was from a rat. Okay, so those two structures, the cell body and the dendrites. And then there's a third structure, which are these fine things in the background. And this is what's called the axon of the cell. And this is the output of nerve cells. And that's in red here. So this is the way this nerve cell communicates with other nerve cells, by the information going along the axon, and then that axon hooking up with the dendrites of another neuron. And that's how this cell then communicates with this cell. Okay? Everybody with me? Stop me if I'm going off. Let me just check what comes next. So, it turns out that this type of cell, they have these little forms on them, which are called, you see this little roughness along here, they're called spines. And each of those spines is receiving a little bit of information from another nerve cell. And this cell has about 15,000 spines. So we're going to look at one of these spines now, not in the light microscope, but in the electron microscope. So we're going to an electron microscope, which gives us a much higher magnification. So let's just go back a second. So look at one of these little tiny forms here. And we'll go to the electron microscope. And then that's the little tiny form there. And then this is an axon from another cell. So what we have here, it's a dendrite of one cell and an axon of another cell making contact with it. And there are 15,000 coming into this single cell. And then this type of cell can send out and contact maybe 500 or 600 other cells. Now, this is not quite to scale, so the ratio of the cell body to the dendrites is about the right scale, but the axon is not the right scale. The axon, if it was to scale, would probably be maybe 20 meters long, maybe 50 meters long. Some cells, maybe even 100 or more meters long. That would be a little bit impractical up here to have a 50 meter long axon. Okay, so.
Does that contact with just one dendrite, or can it contact with many, or does it change? Or?
Yeah, they're all combinations of connections occur. So this axon can make multiple connections onto this. It will then contact many, many other cells as well, sometimes maybe one connection, maybe many connections. So let's just look at one of these connections.
But is there always only one axon?
A cell only has one axon, but can make thousands of connections. Let's just look at one of these now in higher magnification. So I'm saying they're making connections, but actually they don't make connections. There's a little gap there between this and this, and this is illustrated on the next slide. High magnification. So here we now have a dendrite cut in that plane, and then here is an axon terminal, an axon of another cell coming onto it here. And actually, if you look very carefully, it doesn't make a contact. There's a little gap here. And this is called the synapse. So you've probably heard about synapses. The synapse is the way that one cell communicates with another, one nerve cell communicates with another nerve cell, and there's not continuity there. So how does this thing talk to this thing? There's a little gap there, and there's no continuity. And what it does is it uses a chemical signal. And these little round things here, not the black ones, the sort of light ones, are little packets of the chemical that this uses to communicate with this. It releases the chemical here, that diffuses across this gap, or the synaptic cleft, and then interacts with proteins on this dendrite, which changes then the properties of this dendrite. So I think I've got a little model of it here. So what we're looking at here is the axon and the dendrite, and we have these vesicles containing the chemical, and when the communication is occurring, this fuses with the membrane, out comes a chemical, diffuses across here, and interacts with proteins on the dendrite of the next neuron. And 15,000 are going into that type of neuron. So there's chemicals swirling around everywhere in the brain. And there's many different chemicals used by different nerve cells, and the properties and the effects of those chemicals are different on different dendrites and different nerve cells. It's highly complicated. And we get into the Brian Cox region now. So I'll do my Brian Cox impression. There's 10 to the power of 15 synapses probably in the human brain. So there are billions and billions of synapses in the brain.
Quite good.
I would not do it with an earshot. So all these synapses, millions of them, so there's many different types of chemicals which produce the signals. And the one we're interested in today is a chemical called dopamine. And that's what's going wrong in Parkinson's disease. And interestingly, just as an aside, almost every single drug which is used to treat something to do with the nervous system, or most social drugs, for instance, alcohol, or anybody who has cigarettes, or people who are drinking coffee and caffeine, any drug which affects the brain alters transmission either at all synapses or at subpopulations of synapses. So caffeine will probably interact with most synapses. Alcohol also will interact with most synapses. But some of the drugs we use to treat diseases of the brain will just influence disease. And of course, drugs of abuse as well, cocaine, amphetamine, this sort of thing, influence transmission at these synapses.
Can you talk about the frequency of these things are happening in electrical terms?
You'll see that in a second, next couple of slides. Okay, so there's chemical transmission between neurons, but the signaling within a nerve cell, so the information transfer from here to here, and then the information coming down here to tell it to release a chemical is electrical. So these are electrical signals. And we would have predicted that from looking at the computer. You'd assume worked out that these electrical signals are in there. And the signal that we refer to is the action potential, which is the nerve impulse. So electrical signals come down here, and at this point is generated a nerve impulse, which propagates along here. When it reaches here, it causes the release of the chemical. Now, on the next slide, I'm going to show you, which I really love this slide. So it's totally geeky. This is recording the electrical activity from a single nerve cell, a single dopamine nerve cell, it's either a rat brain or a mouse brain, I can't remember. The electrical signals are, action potentials are about 1 millivolt in magnitude, or thousands of a volt. The duration is probably 1 to 2 or 3 milliseconds. And you can, this neuron probably goes at a rate of about 3 to 5 hertz under resting conditions, but it can go up to 50 or 60 hertz.
Got your sound off the moment.
Okay. So I'm going to set this going. So it's an anaesthetized animal, and there's an electrode in the brain, and we're recording from one single nerve cell. And what we do is we take that electrical signal, and we put it through all the jiggery-pokery stuff we have, electronic stuff, and each nerve impulse we cause to make a sound, a bop, bop. So you'll hear this nerve cell firing its action potentials. Okay. So that'll be along the top here, and at the bottom here you'll see global activity of lots of nerve cells going together. What you would refer to as brain waves. Now, in the first couple of seconds there's some white noise, and then it'll clean up. And there.
These are little punches of action potential.
Every single one of that 80, let's say 80 billion or 90 billion nerve cells in your brain is doing this most of the time. Buzzing away like this. Sending these nerve impulses along here, causing the release of chemicals which are then diffusing the nerves. Probably, I guess, so the people I've shown this slide to, maybe a total of 200. How many people working in labs recall from dopamine neurons? Maybe another 200. Probably only less than 1,000 people in the whole of eternity have ever heard or seen a dopamine neuron firing like that. Tell that to your great grandchildren. Okay, so I've really gone through this. So the chemical, the electrical impulse comes. I'll use this part. Electrical impulse comes along here, changes electrical properties here, which causes this to come here, release the chemical transmitter here, interacts with this, and then changes the electrical properties of the next nerve cell, which will eventually then lead into more.
Sorry, question. Okay. So when you're releasing the vesicles, presumably new ones are coming in at the same rate? Or is there a time when they get covered and there's like a little build-up and then it's...
The rate that's going on in our brains now, there's time for recovery. So this transmitter will come out and will be taken back up into here, into the presynaptic structure, and then repackaged to be reused. And then all the time, the stuff coming from the cell body, and all the time it's being synthesized. So as we're functioning, you won't get a rundown. But in experimental situations, we can do that. We can make a cell fire so fast that you do get a rundown.
And is one impulse one vesicle, or is it many, or
hundreds? That's a whole complicated field. So one impulse can cause sufficient depolarization to cause a release of one or many vesicles.
Just really vigorous mental effort. Is that enough to push those boundaries?
No, I don't think so. No. So when you're doing using vigorous mental effort, then you're employing different pathways and different networks in the brain. Yeah, so it's not going to push it.
So the fact that you feel shattered at the end of the day has got nothing to do with it.
I think it's probably because we use the brain uses some vast proportion of our energy.
25%.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, I'm bloody knackered. I get home.
So it's glucose lack or something else. That's what you can feel. Low blood glucose.
Okay, so let's go back to Parkinson. Now you know how the brain works. 80 billion of these, all working together, all interacting, all releasing this stuff, and all buzzing away. Of course, but in a real reductionist way, that is how the brain works. So what goes wrong with Parkinson's disease? We go back to Parkinson's disease, and we know exactly what goes wrong with Parkinson's disease. We know exactly what goes wrong that gives you those motor symptoms. And it's shown here, on this slide here. So this is a part of the brain called the midbrain. This is from somebody who died not with Parkinson's disease. And then on this side, it's somebody who died with Parkinson's disease. And you can see very clearly what the difference is. This dark substance here is missing on this side. This is neuromelanin, and that's neuromelanin, which is contained in the cell bodies of neurons, which are called dopamine, that use dopamine to communicate with other nerve cells. So when you get Parkinson's disease, these die, and then you end up with none of the neuromelanin there, because you've lost those neurons. You've lost the dopamine neurons, which are situated in this region. Just anybody want to guess what that region's called? It's what did you say?
The black stuff.
Exactly right. Substantia nigra. It's called the substantia nigra. That region's called the substantia nigra. Dopamine neurons are there. In Parkinson's disease, they die, and there's a progressive loss of that's the dopamine, and the severity of your motor symptoms correlates very tightly with the degree of loss of dopamine. And we can look at it in a living brain. So this is a PET scan, positron emission tomography scan, and you can look at the release of dopamine. So here we were looking at this is the cell body of dendrites. Now we're going to go to the region of the brain where the dopamine is being released. here's a normal person, this is the striatum, it's called the striatum, here's a normal person, this is a signal for dopamine release, and then this is the signal for somebody with Parkinson's disease. There's a dramatic reduction in the release of dopamine where it's doing its thing. And that correlates then with your motor symptoms. Actually, this PET scan is the earliest you can diagnose, using this tool is the earliest you can diagnose Parkinson's disease. The problem is, it costs about £2,000 to £3,000 a go. And it's not not a thing that you can use normally. Okay, so what we're going to do now is to look and see what dopamine does at this level. So we're going to go here, and we're going to use the electron microscope again. So here we are. This is the axon terminal of the dopamine neuron. And what it's doing is it's contacting, if you remember this cell at the beginning, it's contacting this cell. And it's contacting the spines of these cells here. And the spines are also receiving other input. So what dopamine does is to change the response of this spine to activity in this axon here. This is the block diagram we use all the time when we're studying the basal ganglia. So what goes wrong in Parkinson's disease is that these dopamine neurons die in the substantia nigra compactor. The axon dies. These synapses go. We get the motor symptoms. Now, why the link between the loss of that synapse and the motor symptoms is a giant leap, but we actually don't know why the loss of those synapses leads to these motor symptoms. We know that dopamine is important. All we can say is dopamine is important in controlling.
What's killing the dopamine?
Good question.
Why don't other neurons die as well?
Just like that. Okay, so why don't other neurons die? Well, actually, lots of other neurons do die. So there's hypotheses at the moment that actually Parkinson's disease is not a disease of the substantia nigra. It's a disease of the brain, of the nervous system, and that a wave of pathology starts right down here. Actually, maybe it starts in the enteric nervous system. The wave of pathology spreads through the brain, and when it gets to the midbrain, where those dopamine neurons are exquisitely sensitive at dying. They die very easily. So when that wave of pathology gets to there, then these neurons die, and you get the motor symptoms. And meanwhile, you have lost other neurons, and those, the loss of those others may underlie some of the other symptoms of the disease.
But you get people at 93.
Yeah.
That don't have Parkinson's.
Yeah.
So their dopamine neurons are fine.
They're probably beginning to die off, but we just don't see, because you need 15 or 20 years of loss of dopamine before you see the symptoms. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we don't know why. Mm-hmm. So the factors that are causing the death of the dopamine. So there are many, many, many people who work on this, trying to understand it, as they are in Alzheimer's disease and in motor neuron disease. What we know is aging, normal aging. Age is the greatest risk factor for Parkinson's disease. If you don't want to get Parkinson's disease, don't want to get Alzheimer's disease, die young. But we don't want to do that. So it's part of the aging process. We don't know what it is. It may be all these other things as well. There's some genetic forms of Parkinson's disease coming to light over the years. There are a few genetic forms of Parkinson's disease, probably accounts for maybe 2 or 3 or 4%, and we know precisely what's going wrong, what gene's going, what protein's going. We don't really know yet why that protein or that altered protein is causing the disease. We have this thing called excitotoxicity. So if you get an excitatory transmitter and it's too excited, the cell gets too excited, it can lead to calcium doing funny things and so on. Mitochondria, the powerhouse of every cell in the body where energy is generated from food, it appears in Parkinson's disease as some dysfunction of the mitochondria. Exogenous toxins. So Parkinson's disease is slightly more common in the industrialized world. And there are things in the environment which can kill dopamine neurons. For instance, paraquat, which is an insecticide or a herbicide. And there's another one called rotenone, which the organic people say is an organic pesticide. It's organic pesticide because it comes from plants. You can extract it from the roots of the leaves from a whole variety of plants. Rotenone kills mitochondria, and if you treat an animal with rotenone, it kills their dopamine neurons, and then they die. So there are things in the environment. This thing called oxidative stress, because as you get older, you get less better at dealing with very reactive chemicals in your body. And then once things start, then inflammation can start. As cells begin to die, inflammation can start. So I don't think there's any one cause. So what I think is happening is that things have to come together in your brain. A combination of aging and then genetic risk factors, which we don't even know about yet. And then many other things have to come together, which then will eventually lead to the nerve cell death.
What about alcohol?
I don't think so, no. But there's a lower incidence of Parkinson's disease in people who smoke. And that probably relates to the nicotine interacts with the dopamine neurons and causes the release of dopamine.
Can you tell us what molecular structure of dopamine is?
Ooh, I'm going to ask.
It's a big molecule.
It's not very big, no.
It's an aromatic amine, very small.
It is very tiny.
This guy works on the release of it over here, and he's going to show you the structure. Okay, so let's just move to now how we can treat Parkinson's disease. Am I going on too long? Just a few more minutes. So how do we treat Parkinson's disease, and what are the possibilities for the future? What I'm teaching this Parkinson's neurological disorder is I say, if you have a choice of a neurological order to get Parkinson's disease. Don't get Alzheimer's, don't get motor neuron disease. Get Parkinson's disease, because we can treat it for a long time. So the strategies are, there are several strategies. There's drug therapy, which I'll go through in a moment. Then there's these surgical methods. And these give you symptomatic relief from the disease. And this symptomatic relief can last for a long time, for decades, really. And then there are other approaches which are not in practice yet, which alter the course of the disease, which stop the dopamine neurons dying or replace the dopamine neurons. So I'll go through each of these. So drug therapy. So we know for a long time precisely the synthetic pathways of dopamine, mainly through actually scientists who worked here in Oxford in the 70s, basically. So we synthesize dopamine from this amino acid. There's an enzyme called tyrosine hydroxylase, which produces this substance, L-DOPA, and then another enzyme, you get dopamine synthesized. So dopamine is synthesized here in the axon terminals and released. If you haven't got if your dopamine neurons are going, then you're getting less and less dopamine being released. Just give dopamine. Why not just give dopamine? Actually, you can't do that because dopamine doesn't get into the brain. Actually, dopamine is taken up by other nerve cells and converted into something else and upsets your cardiovascular system. So what was introduced in the late 60s, early 70s by a man called Hornikeyevich, who was working here in Oxford. He was an Austrian, and he went back to Austria after having been told by his supervisor, you work on dopamine in the brain, that's the future. And he went back and identified the loss of dopamine in Parkinson's disease and then introduced this treatment, L-DOPA, the precursor of dopamine. And this is the main treatment for Parkinson's disease. Main treatment for Parkinson's disease. I should have this next slide on. Sorry. So that increases the synthesis of dopamine. The reason it increases the synthesis is because this is a rate-limiting step. As I said, we can't use dopamine itself, but we can use drugs that mimic the action of dopamine. So there are a whole host of drugs which mimic the action of dopamine. They stimulate those dopamine receptors and do the same thing as dopamine. And these can be taken orally, or they can be taken by injection, or you can have patches where it diffuses into the body. So it's mimicking the action of dopamine. And then when dopamine is released, some of it is taken back up into the cell. Some of it is metabolized by an enzyme. So you can block that enzyme so that it's not broken down, so more dopamine hangs around for a long time. And in fact, that's probably the first choice of drug at the moment. It's called a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So the enzyme is monoamine oxidase. It's a It's interesting because Mao Zedong had Parkinson's disease, by the way, we're not for this. Did we get that? Sorry. And it's the drug, it's Selegiline, which people use. But I'm just going to show you this, the treatment with L-Dopa. So if you remember this guy a moment ago, this guy who was in his garden and was shuffling along, the early onset Parkinson's disease, he takes his oral dose of L-Dopa, and probably 10 or 15 minutes later, it's incredible.
10 minutes later.
It does have some slight motor disturbances, but not so much. So he now, from being trapped in his body, just takes a drug and he can function normally. And in its 10, 15, or 20 years after your diagnosis of Parkinson's, you can function normally. That's why I say get Parkinson's disease and not motor neuron disease. The drugs don't work. So L-DOPA, of course, what you need is, just go back a second, you need some dopamine neurons there to go through the synthetic pathway to produce dopamine. And the disease is progressive, and you're losing more and more of your dopamine neurons. So eventually, L-DOPA becomes less and less effective, and it starts to produce strange side effects. So we do need other treatments. Another treatment which came along was based on real basic science. So the basic science, which was done in the 80s, principally, understanding the organization of the basal ganglia, understanding what was going on in the basal ganglia. And we realized that there are two pathways of information flow through the basal ganglia. There's what's called a direct pathway and an indirect pathway. You don't really need to know that. But what came out was that in models, in motor disturbances, it appears that one of the pathways which inhibits movement was overactive. So the surgeons then said, well, why don't we try and reduce that overactivity? So they did a variety of things, one was to make lesions in here, but what they do now is to do this deep brain stimulation, which you may have heard of, where you implant in the brain, actually in this structure here, the electrode, you have a wire buried under your skin, coming down here, and you have a stimulator here. And you apply high frequency stimulation, which what it does is, what it's supposed to do is to inactivate those neurons, reduce activity in this pathway, which was overactive in Parkinson's disease. And in doing so, it restores function. So this is, again, incredibly dramatic. So this is a guy who, like you saw earlier on, late stage Parkinson's, he's not on his treatment now, he's been operated on, he's got his electrodes in his brain. He can't do anything. And then you'd have an induction coil, you put it there, you turn on the stimulator, and then off he goes. Which is just sort of ridiculous that it works. And it works incredibly well. Probably there's 80 or 90,000 people being treated worldwide by this method. But of course this is a method of treatment for the West, not for developing countries. This is £10,000, £15,000 a go, so it's not a thing for developing countries. Okay, so that's what we have at the moment. We have these drug therapies, we have this deep brain stimulation, but that is not altering the progression of the disease. It's just reducing the symptoms of the disease so that you can function normally. What we need is therapies to alter the progression of the disease, stop those neurons dying, or replace those neurons. So one of the approaches is transplantation. So you're losing your dopamine neurons, put some dopamine neurons back in your brain, and see what happens. And a lot of experiments were done in the 80s and 90s using fetal tissue. So this is actually ethical problems as well. So they were taking the brains of aborted fetuses, taking the dopamine neurons from those fetuses, combining them, getting enough to inject into the brain of people with Parkinson's disease. And it did have some function, some restoration of function. So if you look here at Yeah, this is a person. This is a normal subject. We're looking at the same sort of signal we were looking at a moment ago. This bright signal is dopamine being released from its axon terminals here. And then this is somebody with Parkinson's disease. This is a side where they haven't had a transplant, and this is the side where they've had a transplant. So they're releasing dopamine on that side of the brain. This does give some restoration of function, although there have been problems with it, and it's been stopped for the moment, for the past few years, and then things are trying to get sorted out again. For me, fetal tissue is not the solution. It's not the solution. What we need is animal tissue, perhaps. You know, we put pig valves into our hearts. Maybe we could, at some point, use animal tissue. And, of course, the great hope at the moment is stem cells. The great hope for in the Parkinson's and neurodegenerative sufferers and carers community is stem cells. And the fact that we can now take my skin, I can mash it up, I can get the cells out, and, well, the scientific community, actually the groups in Oxford can do it that I work with, and convert them into stem cells, and then you can convert them into dopamine neurons. So then the hope is that one day you'll be able to use your own stem cells, or stem cells from somebody who's not suffering from Parkinson's disease, to make dopamine neurons, to put them into your brain. That's the future. I don't know what's going to happen. We're, many groups and many organizations are looking for neuroprotective therapies, drugs which protect neurons from dying. So this is not only important for Parkinson's, it is for Alzheimer's, it is for motor neuron disease and other diseases. So there are hundreds of compounds and hundreds of things being looked at. Nothing is coming through in Parkinson's disease. There's been many clinical trials, and it may be the problem with the expense and the design of the trials, but nothing is coming through that is working to prevent your nerve cells dying. Another approach is to stimulate the cells that are there to grow. So you put in nerve growth factors. So this is called glial-derived neurotrophic factor. And actually there are trials going on at the moment where we're injecting into the brain GDNF to try and stimulate the growth and expansion of the neurons that are left and maybe produce new neurons. And then finally, the approach, of course, is one we hope would be gene therapy as well. So gene therapy is a possibility of using a gene to produce a therapeutic effect. So if you have a genetic disease, then you would deliver a correct copy of the gene to that person. Most of Parkinson's disease is not genetic, so it would be complicated. But what people try is to use a gene which produces a protein which might be useful for the brain for a Parkinson's patient. So, for instance, tyrosine hydroxylase, that enzyme that's involved in the production of dopamine. And there are trials going on where it's been injected into the brain, genes to produce, make cells produce more dopamine. But you could also perhaps put genes in which would make these growth factors as well. But again, these are really in the head over when they will come through, or they will come through. So I'm going to stop there, but I'm going to just show you one more video, which I really love. And this is a video of which you all recognize now, of somebody with serious Parkinson's disease. Classic symptoms, shuffling gait, tremor. She's not trying to trip him up there. She's trying to give him a stimulus to move. So when you sometimes have difficulty starting, if you're given a stimulus, then you can start. So she'll do it again a couple of times. Alright, he starts, and then he goes what Parkinson described, goes into this. And this actually causes a lot of falls in Parkinson's patients as well, which is a big problem.
She could trip on my foot.
Pushing you over as well. Okay, so you'll see him in a moment. They're going to take him outside into the car park. I put him on a bicycle. I think this is from the Netherlands. And look at him. He just goes off.
Why is that one?
This woman suddenly realizes she's being filmed. Watch. So this is a guy, untreated, he's off. He does this figure of eight, and when he turns around.
And he couldn't turn around walking like that.
No.
Watch it when he comes down a bit. He gets up on his haunches to get going.
But he's what? Under treatment at this point.
He has no treatment. Look, he's only standing up on his pedals.
So why
he's
going to
put his brake. Watch him. He's going to put his brakes on. And then he's going to jump off the bike. And he can't move.
No wonder I chose to cycle.
Isn't that amazing? So my clinical colleague's telling me that this is a very, very rare event. And this is just an interesting, interesting subject. So I'll finish there, and I think we'll take a break now, and we could have more questions and discussion.
Yeah.